Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. Hey, do you see, I don't remember if I forwarded this question to you or if you, we both got copied on it, but one of our listeners or followers on Ascendo sent in a question that seemed to be more in your world than my world. And it was dealing with FMEA and online and recording or not recording. And it had a few other elements to it too. But do you remember that question?
I do. That was it was a great question. I'm sure it's on the minds of lots of people, but it's the first time we've received it as like a question that could be added to our podcast topics.
Mm-hmm. And we did. We added it to it. So could you summarize that question real quick?
Absolutely. So this is a gentleman who is preparing to perform FMEAs on a certain area. And he had been reading the My Effective FMEA materials and the book and that type of thing. And both on Inside FMEA at Ascendo. And they're basically establishing their ground rules because they were going to do virtual FMEA sessions. And they wanted to get a sense for what are the legal guidelines for FMEA and particularly for their area. And if I could share my approach when and if legal ground rules apply for FMEAs. So that was the background to it. And of course, it triggered some thoughts with me, and there's a portion of Chapter 5 of Effective FMEAs that talks about legal guidelines, and so I thought, well, that'd be an interesting subject for a podcast.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, my very first hunch on that was, it seems like the wrong question to be asking. It just struck me as, if you're doing an FMEA for potential use in a legal case later, you've kind of missed the point of an FMEA. You're doing it for the wrong reason, is kind of what I was thinking. You know, if FMEA to me is a tool to help the design team, you know, for a design FMEA or the team get organized and focus on things and talk through things. And I've heard it in FMEA sessions that were going well and somebody says, oh, we can't write that down, that they'll know that we thought about that.
Oh.
You know, and I'm like, well, that's the point. Right. I think. And then I use the case of there was some famous case years and years ago where they were able to pull out the FMEA and say, yeah, we thought through that. And here's the logic we used. And here's this, you know, we thought through this. And here's where all the other things that we're working on that were much more serious that we had to work on. And yeah, just because it's very, very rare, and there wasn't a lot of design room for us to do anything about it. We thought about it, but we decided not to do anything about it. And the court said, all right, you're fine. Whereas if they had absolutely no documentation whatsoever, then they wouldn't have, it would have been the remembrance or whatever that word is of all those engineers, you know, remembering what they did or didn't. Yeah, recollection. Remembering what they did or didn't do. And instead, they had a document. They said, "What? Well, this is part of our process. We think through all this stuff. We didn't think this was serious, and here's why, you know. And so, and here's all the other stuff we did that was serious." And it kind of threw FMEA into the legal courts. But I think it's horse before the cart or cart before the horse when you do an FMEA with an idea that it has to be suitable for a legal case. I think that's backwards.
Yeah, it is backwards. There's some guidelines, and these I've developed over the years, going back to my GM experience and working on documents. There's some guidelines that are appropriate for any type of documents and any type of engineering practice, and they apply to FMEA. But you're right, you want to focus first and foremost on safe and reliable designs. When you're a reliability engineer, that's your focus. Mm-hmm. And documentation, has to follow company guidelines as to what you document and how detailed, that type of thing, how long documents are maintained. But just to tick off some of the ones that I'm recalling from the experience is, I always teach when I'm teaching FMEA, when I talk about entries into worksheets, be factual. Don't be emotional. Don't be unclear. Mm-hmm. Just be factual. Be honest and factual and forthright. And that's appropriate because in an FMEA, you're talking about risk. I mean, we are talking about how things can fail. Right. That's a really important topic. But in the FMEA, we're going to surface where it matters. So we're going to look at the potential impact, which is called severity. We're going to look at, in other words, the seriousness. We're going to look at the likelihood of occurrence. And so you're going to be surfacing risk, and then you'll take action to reduce risk. And the phrase I always use is reduce risk to an acceptable level, because you never get down to zero.
Right.
So it needs to be to an acceptable level. And if you do that and you document it, absence of emotional words and in a factual way, that's perfectly appropriate. I've never run into any problem from a legal department that is inconsistent with that.
Well, it's the same basic guidelines as your lab notebook, right? I'm brainstorming, you label it as such, and I'm thinking through a bunch of options or ideas, and then here's some experiments, and I write down the steps I took, and could I replicate it, and here's the results, and, you know, it's just part of the design process, and it's a way for us to think through a problem, and so documenting it such that the document isn't for the legal team. The document is for that design team to come back to it in 2 months and go, all right, now let's update this. We know more stuff now.
Yeah.
Right. It's not for anybody else. It's for that design team, but yet it still needs to be clear so that in 2-3 months after lots and lots has gone on, you can still use it and still remember what it was saying.
And that's an important point about any type of document. It needs to be clear enough, because sometimes when you're in a meeting, you're going, okay, well, you put down some kind of notation that only you or somebody that was there would understand. Mm-hmm. And what I believe personally is that write it so that if you happen to be on vacation someday and somebody else comes in, they at least can understand what you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. And another one that really bothered me early on, and I could go back to my GM experience there, but I'll just summarize it this way, which is don't create open loops. So if, like in an FMEA, if you say recommend you're going to change whatever to something, that's a recommendation. Then there's a column in the FMEA called action taken.
Right.
And don't forget to do that.
Yeah. And that is so common. It's rare that I see a team actually close that. Yeah, they build, and part of it is they'll build it into their work structure, right? It's part of the design. The design may be already under design control, so it's documented mm-hmm. there. And I'm like, okay, well, that's a little convoluted. Yeah, you could figure it out, but it's not clean. But it's a time and constraint thing and discipline thing. But I agree with you that using the FMEA document is an ongoing document, and keeping that recommendations and that we chose to do it, or we learned enough that this doesn't make sense, or, you know, whatever, but document it. And I have almost never seen that done, though. That's the hard part.
It is the hard part. And you're absolutely right. It should be a living document during product development. I mean, you don't have to keep it alive for forever and ever, but
right.
but during product development, because then you can assess whether or not the risk that you identified is reduced to an acceptable level. And in other words, you redo the severity, occurrence, and detection mm-hmm. Ratings. And that's the way it should work. And so I think it's a good practice. And like you say, I don't do that just because it's a legal thing. Mm-mm. I do that because it makes sense that we want to reduce risk to an acceptable level. So I think all of these things are common sense.
Yeah. Now, what do you think of the practice of, I mean, we did an FMEA. I was with the small team, and we did the FMEA, and we ended up with like 8 or 9 recommendations. And some were investigations, some were, you know, let's change this or explore this change or stuff like that. And we were pretty much managing by a defect tracker system. So it was every week we had a meeting of what did we learn this week from our prototypes, from our manufacturers, from our suppliers, from, you know, whatever. We had a design ready to go, but we're building it and testing it and doing all this stuff. And so the weekly meetings and the weekly charges and allocation of resources is all being done in this defect tracker bug list, essentially. And so what the project manager did, it was took those recommendations and added them to the bug list. And so they became prioritized with all the other things that were going on with the program. And the high recommendations, the 9 or 10 type stuff, got a lot of attention, naturally. But it just got built into the existing system to track tasks, to track activities and investigations and stuff like that.
I think that's a terrific idea. And I recommend to teams to take the recommendations, particularly for the higher risk issues, and get them integrated into the project tracking systems. Everybody's got a different, there's doors, there's all these different systems in place. But whatever a company's using, then it'll happen.
That's right.
Rather than pushing out a rope somewhere off as a separate process.
Right. But then back to the closed loop thing on the document is we would put the bug number or the, we could find, we put a notation in action taken, see XYZ document in our system. So then it became, it was a handoff is the closing the loop on the FMEA.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is they don't like to use the FMEA to accomplish testing. In other words, you have companies have a DVPNR or design verification plan and report system in their, as part of their organization. And so if you want to change the tests from the FMEA, which sometimes is a good idea if if your tests don't detect a particular failure mode, then I recommend to add a test or modify a test, but I don't put recommendation FMEA in the FMEA to conduct the test because then we're double tracking.
Right.
I don't want the FMEA to do something that someone else is already doing.
Okay. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff's just pretty much common sense and in what we do with our documentation anyway, right? Now, do you think the FMEA document itself should be a controlled document, like a drawing?
Well, now we're getting into company policy. If companies are at the level of maturity where they're controlling their documents, which is they should be doing, then an FMEA, when it reaches a certain point, can become a controlled document. And that way, when changes are made after the FMEA is essentially done, it's been through recommendations, we believe we've got the right recommendations in place, and or they've already got the actions taken. So at some point, that can become a controlled document, and then that can be appropriate. Yeah. If that administrative process is in place,
well, then it becomes a snapshot of the document as it evolves, and it also becomes findable for the next team or for any purpose after that.
Yes, it does. You can give it a version number, and it becomes great input to the next version. Like you have a widget, and then 2 years later, you have a widget plus. But you got the widget FMEA well documented.
Right. It's a great jumping off point, a lot of people think. Now, one of the things that was interesting in this question that we got or that you responded to was, should I record it? I mean, if you're on Zoom already or equivalent internal online system and doing it, and there was a whole raft of thoughts in my head about, well, how do you do this remotely when it's usually a very intimate discussion. You're diving into making the designer feel bad because we're talking about all the ways this product looks ugly. But there's all kinds of issues on that. But I thought that the idea of, well, should I record this or not? And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question. My reply to the person who wrote that was my preference would be not recording. And because to me, the document is the consensus of the team. And I don't see any reason to record all the, somebody said this and then somebody interrupted and somebody threw out a comment and all the different nuances that go into that consensus. I don't see any value to having that recorded because the document is the record.
Right.
And so my personal preference is using the document as the record, not all the voice comments and stuff like that, which go into it. And I'm also concerned in terms of I want the team to be completely open.
Right.
When you're having that discussion, I don't want people to hold back or anything. And so That's my preference, but that is very much a company decision. So I told him to go back and talk to his company and make sure that whatever he decides is consistent with their policy, because that's an important decision for a company.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I agree with you. My first thought was, is as soon as I put a camera in there, the conversation changes. It's and you're right. It's a consensus, and it is a messy process. It's back and forth and discussion, and who knows what, and what information do we have or don't have, and what's an assumption, what's not, and it does require that free flow of information. And one, if it's a barrier, I mean, if we were, for example, if you were doing the FMEA and any comment or any failure mode got your initials next to it, that would, in my opinion, that would shut down the conversation.
Yes, it would. I agree. You know what? What I teach is I like conflict. I particularly debate. Let's put it that way. Disagreement. I think disagreement is a really important part of getting to consensus. And if people aren't willing to disagree, then you'll get one person. Whoever speaks first will prevail, and everybody else will sort of nod their head. So I like people to say, "No, I disagree with that," and then you say, "Why do you disagree with it?" and stuff like that. I don't see any reason that needs to be recorded.
I don't think it would help even if you're trying to, complete the document later or something like that. That has to be done visibly to the team so that you can get the consensus. Yeah, that makes sense. That's consistent. All right. That's what we agree with. But, trying to do it later doesn't help.
Another almost a similar question is, what about inviting my management to an FMEA? And I say, no,
Only if
don't
they're
do that.
useful.
Exactly. Bring in the subject matter experts, but don't bring in management or a manager, because inevitably the team does a quick look over to kind of see is it okay to speak or not. And so only if the management is manager is a subject matter expert. And even then, I'll talk to the person and say, look, we're bringing you in, but we want you to wear the hat of the subject matter expert, not the management hat.
Well, I think there's a spot, and it doesn't matter. I have that issue when it's the subject matter expert, but they know what's right, and they're going to tell us what the whole story is, right? That's another simple problem. But I think that whoever is perceived as having the positional power, whether it's a senior technician or a senior, buyer or, somebody that others look to for guidance and direction and has some sway over a lot of decisions. And oftentimes that's management, not always. That's a consideration in bringing them in or not. And if it's perceived as that they will shut down other people, then it's, yeah, you got to have a side conversation with them saying, here's what we're trying to do. And this is a way, for that I expect you to behave, essentially. And some people get it, some people don't. But it's a consideration in any of these things.
It is.
I don't know. You've been,
Go ahead. Sorry.
you've been using Zoom a bunch lately. So is it possible, as the administrator of a Zoom call, to mute somebody?
Sure, it is.
Ah, there's extra power online,
Yes. You've seen it when you watch the TV programs, where they have a panel and somebody's doing too much talking and suddenly you can't hear them. But I have a module in my facilitation class where I teach FMEA facilitation on controlling discussion. And, because the extroverts will dominate if you don't control the discussion. So it is an important topic.
Well, you're going to have to update it for the online tools now.
I am. In fact, that's another topic for another podcast, but there's a lot of lessons learned that are cropping up.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm just thinking one of my favorite ways to do it is don't make eye contact and hold your hand up like a stop sign, and usually that shuts somebody off. They just recognize, oh, wait a sec, I got to slow down. And then what it does is it signals to the rest of the group that, yeah, we want to hear from other people, and it's okay. And we'll come back to you, but it's very subtle, but that would not work on a Zoom call. Like my cat would wonder why I'm waving at
Yes. Well, what, and before we go shift into that subject, let me just bring up one more thing on the legal side, which is I'm thinking years past, where someone said, to me outside of the FMEA. They said, well, you know, I got this thing, but I don't know if I want to bring it up there because it's pretty risky, you know. And so the question becomes, should you bring up something that is a safety issue or whatever? And I say yes.
Yeah, I agree too.
Down on the side of absolutely. If you're concerned about it, bring it up.
Yeah, it's not really the, what do they call a whistleblower? It's not that venue for whistleblowing. We're not accusing anybody of doing anything wrong, but hey, I noticed this thing over here. This is not right. This is dangerous, or this is a problem. Have we thought through this yet? That's appropriate, and I think. And I agree with the way you run FMEAs, Carlos. It's not a spot where we blame anybody, right? It's a spot where we recognize the risks that are in front of us and then deal with them.
Yeah, and if you're concerned about a rare but high-risk issue, well, then when you get to the effect column, you can say with potential for injury, with potential for that. That describes it accurately. Mm-hmm. It's not 100% this is going to occur. So you just state it carefully and honestly and accurately. By all means, bring up issues. That's the whole job of the FMEA is to get everything on the table and then kind of sift through what's high risk and what isn't.
Yeah. No, sounds good. I think I shifted the conversation a little bit. Were there other guidelines you wanted to mention? Or?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I was just sort of looking at, as we were talking, I was sort of ticking off some of my memories of these things. And those are the guidelines that I shared with the gentleman. And they're in Chapter 5 of my book. If anybody has the book, I've got a whole section on legal ground rules. And it's common sense. But please, if you're listening, always, and this is not just a disclaimer, I really believe this, always be sure that you're consistent with your company legal guidelines.
Yeah. No, all good. So with that non-legal disclaimer.
Non-disclaimer
that we got there. And we're moving into this new world of online meetings more and more, and a lot of us are getting way too much experience with this. And dealing with FMEAs and dealing with legal considerations. Hopefully, Carl, we made the point that doing an FMEA with an eye over your shoulder to the legal team, oh God, can you think if you invited a lawyer to your FMEA?
Should we say this or not?
Yeah, that would shut down the meeting.
Right.
But the idea is that the FMEA has a purpose. Focus on that. Do a good job. Be clear. Stay factual. And consistent with your documentation policies within the company. And that will serve you well. I think that's all. It just makes common sense. Now, there's separate wrinkles for doing this online. And I think that's the subject for a whole nother discussion. And,
indeed.
Yeah. So with that, Carl, let's ask our listeners, if you got any questions or elements of this or things you're thinking through in this regard, let us know. We're over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a contact form there. Carl and I are both have contact information and forms on our about pages on Ascendo. Plus you can find us on LinkedIn, and we look forward to hearing from you. So with that, Carl, I think we'll wrap this one up.
Wrap it up. Very good, Fred. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.